So this and other evidence, this passage from Acts, point to the first Christians, at least those in Jerusalem, as possessing an understanding of themselves as being part of Israel, the children of Abraham. They saw themselves as Jews who accepted that Jesus of Nazareth was the promised Messiah who had been crucified and rose from the dead. And to repeat myself, being Jews, they worshipped as they always had worshipped. They observed the rhythm of Jewish religious life in the great temple that Herod the Great had built. Their diets didn't change. Their understanding of the law and its observances to that time did not change. However, they did understand that something had changed. Something had changed because Christ was risen from the dead and they had received the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. Another considerable evidence of Jews, of the early Christians' awareness of themselves as Jews, is simply the first great council of the Christian church. I hate to tell you, it was not held in Nicaea. It was held in Jerusalem. St. Paul, who was ministering to the Gentiles, had to answer to the other apostles about his conviction that Gentile converts did not need to be circumcised. You did not need to become a Jew first before becoming a Christian. And again, it's awareness of, you know, imagine you're a Jewish Christian living in Jerusalem. You were circumcised. Your father was circumcised. Everybody in your, you know, and you understand that Jesus was the Messiah that was promised to come to the Jews, you know. So naturally, anybody else who came from the Greek world should be circumcised like you. That was simply how they saw themselves and their world and understood their place in the tradition of the people of God. And St. Paul comes along and says, no. No, you don't have to become a Jew first. You don't have to observe the Jewish dietary laws. And in fact, it's told us in the book of the laws that Christian, the new converts from the Gentiles were expected to do two things besides being baptized. They were simply to live moral lives and not eat blood. So those of you who like blood sausage. Now, Jewish worship was ordained and ordered by God himself. In Exodus chapters 35 through 40 and the book of Leviticus, we have set forth for us how divine worship was expected by God to be accomplished. And all the multitude of the children of Israel being gathered together, he, Moses, said to them, these are the things which the Lord hath commanded to be done. 6 days ye shall do work. The seventh day shall be holy to you, the Sabbath, and the rest of the Lord. He that shall do any work on it shall be put to death. So if your neighbor is mowing his lawn on Saturday, he's not supposed to do that. Moses said to all the children, all the assembling of the children of Israel, this is the word of the Lord. The Lord hath commanded, saying, set aside with you first fruits to the Lord. Let everyone that is willing and hath a ready heart offer them to the Lord, gold, silver, brass, violet, and purple, and scarlet twice dyed. From Leviticus, he, the high priest, shall be vested with a linen tunic. He shall cover all his nakedness with linen breeches. He shall be girded with a linen girdle, and he shall put on a linen mitre upon his head. For these are holy vestments, all which he shall put on after he is washed. And he shall receive from the whole multitude of the children of Israel 2 goats for sin and 1 ram for holocaust. We're going to come back to that. But again, the liturgy, how God was to be worshipped, is set forth in the books of the Torah. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and thou shalt say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do according to the custom of the land of Egypt, in which you dwelt. Neither shall you act according to the manner of the country of Canaan, into which I will bring you. Nor shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall do my judgments, and shall observe my precepts, and shall walk in them. Now these two books, and the book of Deuteronomy, so Exodus and Leviticus, and the book of Deuteronomy, about which I will speak a bit later, set forth how Israel was to worship, how the tabernacle was to be constructed, and with what materials it should be built, and the whole pattern and structure of Jewish worship was given to Moses by God, according to Jewish tradition, on Sinai. How Jews were to live their lives in relationship to him and to each other was given to Moses by God on Sinai. And God was very particular about the details of the tabernacle and the rituals to be performed by his high priest on behalf of the people. As I hope to show, these are much more than a how-to-do book for Israel. These form a major part of those clues to which I referred above, and they are not at all incidental. In other words, all of the commandments of worship were not some arbitrary commandment of God, but were there for a particular reason, to reveal something about Jesus Christ, something that was to be understood when the Messiah came. References to the temple and the tabernacle form an important part of the theology of the letter to the Hebrews. In Hebrews, some of these important clues are examined and reviewed. Now, the main point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of majesty in the heavens, a minister of the holies and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord has erected and not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary that this one should also have something to offer. If he then were on earth, he would not even be a priest, since there are already others to offer gifts according to the law. The worship they, the priests of the Old Testament, offer is a mere copy and shadow of things heavenly, even as Moses was warned when he was completing the tabernacle. See, God said, that thou make all things according to the pattern that was shown thee on the mount. But now he, Jesus, has obtained a superior ministry, Christian one, in proportion as he is the mediator of a superior covenant enacted upon the basis of superior promises. Now, I think what's important to note in this selection from the Epistle to the Hebrews is that there's this theological idea that the temple, the tabernacle, and the temple which occurred after were commanded by God to be built in a particular way because they reflected a heavenly reality. In fact, the real temple, the real altar, the place where the liturgy is really offered, is in heaven, before the throne of God. That's what the book of Revelation is about. For Orthodox people, the book of Revelation is not a map to the future as much as it is a book about worship. You see heavenly worship expressed in the opening chapters of the book of Revelation, just as you do in the beginning of the book of Isaiah. Heavenly worship is the real worship, and what's done on earth is done according to a pattern that is given to them by God to reveal the heavenly reality. And the high priest, as we'll hear later on, is simply standing and serving, he is as the presence of God in the temple sanctuary. And in fact, I'll go into this a little bit later, but for our Orthodox understanding of worship, we only have one priest. It's Jesus Christ, who serves exactly as described in this passage from the Hebrews at the heavenly altar. And my job, the job of priests, is to simply be living, moving icons expressing this heavenly reality. When we offer the gifts, we say, they're lifted up and say, thine own of thine own. And we believe that Christ accepts these gifts and offers them to the Father. If you listen to the words of the anaphora, it's not addressed to Jesus Christ. It's addressed to God the Father. Because Jesus Christ is the priest who offers those gifts to the Father at the real altar in heaven. All you have in a Christian church is a
is a large image of a heavenly reality, making it present to you. The patterns and ordinances of the Old Testament were important and precisely given because they pointed to Christ and his high priesthood. What was set forth in the Old Testament was important. As I said, when I was growing up, I tended to see Judaism as monolithic, a whole that never changed. After all, it was given in the Bible, and what was true at one time had to be true at every time. Or so I thought. I had the thought that God gave the law to Moses fully fledged and formed. It was rather naive, and not even what the scriptures themselves revealed. I don't think that this should be in the least some sort of threatening idea that diminishes in any way the Old Testament scriptures. If I may make an analogy, it was very much like a human person. When one is born, one is fully human. But life entails change and growth. The mind is expanded through experience, and the body changes with the years. It is, however, the very same body and the very same mind that emerges from the mother's womb. St. Basil expresses this concept very eloquently in one of the priest's prayers of the Divine Liturgy. When the holy gifts are placed on the altar, after the great entrance, the priest says, "Look down on us, O God, and behold this our service. Receive it." And here we have a kind of unfolding of a kind of the history of worship in the Old Testament. "Receive it, our offering, as thou didst receive the gifts of Abel and the sacrifices of Noah, the whole burnt offerings of Abraham, the priestly offices of Moses and Aaron, the peace offerings of Samuel. Even as thou didst receive from thy holy apostles this true worship, so now in thy goodness accept these gifts from the hands of us sinners, O Lord." I'm reminded each time I pray this prayer of a progression, or if you will, a revelation of worship in time and history. Exactly how God was to be worshipped in the time of Noah was not exactly the same as he was worshipped after the law was given on Sinai to Moses. There was a shift and a change, a further revelation, if you like, that showed a deeper understanding of mankind's relationship to God. But the Bible makes it very clear that this is what God commanded. Human beings were gradually given a deeper vision that eventually pointed to the true worship and real place of worship, the heavenly sanctuary, that place that is so vividly described in the book of Revelation. And we will see that the book of Revelation, at least for Christians, is much more a liturgical book than one that predicts the future. It is a revelation of the heavenly court, a vision of the one altar where the one priest offers himself to the Father eternally. That means outside of time. At this altar, surrounded by his angels, men are invited to sit with and to partake of the heavenly, the wedding supper of the Lamb, to actually eat with God at his table. It represents the fulfillment of all that was foreshadowed in all the offerings of the Old Testament, whether they be those of Noah, Abel, Aaron, or Samuel. It is the real meaning and goal of every sacrifice and holy meal. So, there's a very common misconception that when we're having the Divine Liturgy, we are reenacting the Last Supper. Let me disabuse you of that idea. We're not. We're not reenacting anything. We don't reenact the women going to the tomb on Paschal night. You know? It's not what that procession is about. It's something much more profound. We are sitting at the wedding supper of the Lamb in the book of Revelation. We're sitting at God's table with him. It's a much greater gift than simply living in the past at the Last Supper. When we go around the church on Paschal night, it's, as I said, it's not, you know, pretending to be the women going to the tomb, you know, to see, you know, it's not, you know, bringing myrrh and spices. No, it's actually the procession of the newly baptized
and their integration into the body of Christ. It was on Holy Saturday during those readings, those 15 Old Testament readings, that the newly baptized were baptized and wear white robes, which we'll hear about later, which is very important. They put on white robes and they are marched to the church. And that's why the hymn that we sing instead of the Jesagion that night is "As Many As Have Been Baptized." The same hymn you hear at every baptism. It connects that service of baptism with Holy Saturday, and it's the procession of the newly illumined into the church for the first time, where they heard the creed for the first time. You know, nowadays, we have to teach everybody everything about the Orthodox Church before they become Orthodox. I don't know how many of you were catechized before you became Orthodox, how many were cradle Orthodox, but for those of us who were adults, you know, they told us everything. You know, the resurrection, they told us about icons. In the early years of the church, you didn't know anything about that. You simply learned about the Old Testament. You learned what Jews knew, and you learned not to be like your pagan neighbors. It was after you were baptized, when your eyes were anointed, when you were illumined, that you got to know the deeper things of the church, things the theology of the church. You were exposed to the liturgy, to the Eucharist, to the teachings of Jesus Christ. They were all conveyed to you after you were baptized. And the kind of appendix of that, the kind of vestigial organ of that, is the Sundays after Pascha. They're all part of this lectionary that is part of this catechesis of the newly baptized. So by the time of Christ, Jews had been worshiping God for more than 15 centuries. The first Christians saw the face of Christ in the Old Testament, however. They understood the worship of their fathers to have been a revelation of Christ. Essentially, the first Christians did not see themselves as doing anything new. The rituals of Jewish life, of the Jewish manner of living, took on a new meaning. The ritual baths of Judaism became the baptism of John for the remission of sins. The baptism of John became Christian baptism, entrance into the church, dying and rising with Christ. And I would say for myself, one of my problems as a bishop in receiving and accepting the baptism from Protestant churches and receiving Protestants in the Orthodox Church is exactly because their understanding of baptism is different than ours. For them, it's very much like it's the external witness of the salvation that already occurs when you accepted Jesus in your heart. You went and heard Billy Graham, you know, you went to the altar call, and then the baptism is simply the sign of the salvation that occurred at that moment. That's not the early Christian understanding of baptism. For early Christians, the baptism was entrance, it's burial and rising, it's being buried and rising with Christ, becoming part of his body, becoming entering into his church. It's something a whole theologically different understanding of what baptism is. And it goes with this whole kind of idea that Christ became what Adam is. He took on Adam's flesh, made it his own, died Adam's death. Did you go to the place where Adam was? Sheol. That's what all that stuff of St. John Chrysostom on Pascha night is about in the sermon. He destroys Sheol and transformed the natures of Adam's death by being himself the author of life, coming to the place of the dead and giving them life. And when we are baptized into Christ, we're baptized into that reality. We die with him, he becomes what we are, we become what he is by grace in baptism. So it's a very different idea about what baptism is all about. Jewish festivals like Pentecost. Yes, Pentecost is a Jewish festival. And Passover acquired a new and deeper significance for Christians. The Sabbath was respected, but it was the first day of the week, Sunday, that became the important day for Christians. My Scottish grandparents belonged to a kind of very
traditional Scottish idea, we call it Sabbatarianism. They believed that you had to observe the Sabbath, and on the Sabbath you didn't do anything. You didn't do laundry, you didn't, my grandmother cooked. But it was the Lord's Day, and you didn't do any work on that day, because it was Sunday, and that was the Sabbath. It's just not true. Sabbath is, it always has been, Saturday. Saturday is the day of rest. Sunday is the Lord's Day. It's the eighth day. It's the day beyond time. The number of eight has a very interesting significance in Christianity. It's the day beyond time. The day of the eschaton, of the fulfillment of everything. That's why Sunday is the Lord's Day, and we worship on Sunday. Saturday, it's very interesting. It used to be in the Russian church, I don't know if they just still do it, but you used to sign a paper that said that you promised that you would serve the liturgy on every Saturday and every Sunday as a priest. Because Saturday was the Sabbath. In the Orthodox Church, we still respect the Sabbath day. It's the eighth day. It's the seventh day, but we also have the Lord's Day, which is the seventh day, which is the eighth day. So the seventh day is Sabbath, it's Saturday, and the eighth day is Sunday, which is the day that we Christians gather. Something very, very ancient. In fact, one of the early conflicts in the church was exactly about when we would celebrate liturgy. When would we celebrate Pascha even? Would it be on the Passover, or would it be on the Lord's Day? And of course, we know we celebrate Pascha every on Sundays. So the Jewish and eventually this Jewish ritual meal became the agape and the Eucharist. The agape service is something very interesting. We really have a kind of vestige of that in the Orthodox Church, really only on Pascha anymore. We'll talk about agape vespers. After the Paschal night, after worship, people gather together and usually share food together, right? This is agape. It's a Greek word, one of the several Greek words that we translate as love in English. In the Christian church, in the early years, it was a little bit different. It seems that people gathered together and ate first, so they could go to Starbucks before liturgy, and then they had the Eucharist at the end of it, part of it. And St. Paul kind of complains about the behavior of some of the Christians, that but they came there and they ate too much and drank too much and kind of did not respect the sanctity of this agape meal. And I think it's a very important feature of our Orthodox life in what you might call the dispersion. I don't like that word because it's a the Christian church can never have a dispersion. It's Paul writes to the church in Rome, the church in Corinth, the church in, you know, it's always the church in a particular place. Ethnic groups can have a dispersion. You can have a Greek dispersion. You can have a Jewish dispersion. You can have a Russian dispersion. It means that these are people from that particular ethnic group that live outside of the homeland. And the diaspora is a term that was coined to describe, long before the time of the destruction of the temple, was a term that was used to describe the Greek communities outside of the Greek homeland, in places like Sicily and around the Black Sea. This was the dispersion, the diaspora. And that term became applied to Jewish communities after the destruction of the temple and the destruction of the Jewish state, diaspora. So sometimes when I'm at international Orthodox gatherings, they like to refer to us as the diaspora. You know, there's the Church of Russia, the Church of Greece, and anybody who's outside is in the diaspora. And I always remind them, this is not a Christian term. We're not the diaspora. We are Christian Orthodox Christians who live in this place. You are Orthodox Christians who live in that place. But Christians, and so the kind of main point of this introduction is to underscore the fact that early Christians
did not see themselves as being any different than Jews. They were simply extensions of Judaism into the modern time. Now, at the same time, you have to understand, and we'll talk about this later, there is, at the time of Christ, there are many different Jewish groups. We know some of them. There were the Sadducees. Or when I heard somebody reading the epistle at the military chapel at West Point, the Sadducees. I thought that was very interesting. I was reminded of Amos and Andrew, the Seducers and the Sadducees. But the Sadducees were a particular group of Jews that had particular ideas that others didn't share. One of the things that they believed in, they did not believe in the resurrection. They did not believe in the resurrection. They were associated with the priests and the priestly caste. They were the aristocracy, if you will, of Judaism. They were associated with the priestly caste and were also the wealthy landowners. They had a particular another group of the Pharisees. We hear about Pharisees all the time. Another thing I used to hear in Alaska, I had one student who used to always talk about the Sunday of the Republican and the Pharisee. But Pharisees were another group, and we'll hear a little bit more about them later, because they came out of the Babylonian exile. They become very important as Judaism develops in the the destruction of the temple period, because it's those Pharisees, those people who study the law and interpret the law, that actually move to a place called Tavna, or Jamnia, it's called, as a city it's part of Israel, where they start a school they call the Great Sanhedrin, where they begin to collect the books of the law and start to create a collection called the Talmud, to kind of describe the law. And the Talmud has in it the Mishnah, which is, you know, an interpretation of the law, and then there's the Gemara, which is the kind of dialogue about the law. It's really amazing. I just saw an opera the other day, Salome of Richard Strauss, which is a fantastic opera. But there are these two groups of Jews in this opera who are always arguing with themselves and gives Herod a headache. Well, that's what Pharisees did. They argued about the law. And it's that particular group that survives the destruction of the temple and creates what we call rabbinical Judaism, which we'll talk about later. So I think we are at a little break time.
Yes.
Okay, and then the next thing we're going to talk about is the synagogue. So, why don't we take, how long a break?
15
minute break?